not for the first time, I feel as though the political economy approach always ends up sounding horribly crude compared to the deep political theory and sort of history of it. But I think it's going to chime, it's going to certainly sort of join up a lot of what you've been saying. I mean, the short response that I had to the article was that I agreed with it in sort of profoundly pretty much all the way through. That doesn't make for a very interesting discussion, so I'm just going to try and expand on the point that really spoke to me. And that comes from a context of, I'm currently writing a book on the political economy of the state that has ended up being an exploration of the isomorphism between neoliberalism and Marxism, Leninism. It's basically sort of comparative political economic materialist utopias. And the isomorphism is much deeper than I expected it to be, because it also comes down to the logistics of implementing these things. So the supply side revolution has basically turned into the central planning of the private sector, and it repeats a lot of the pathologies of communist central planning to a really darkly comic extent, and that's pretty much what the book is about. But that's where I'm sort of coming from in this. So like you, I definitely heard echoes of scientific socialism, but again, like Marxism, Leninism, and neoliberalism, I think there's quite a deep isomorphism with those, with those two ideologies. So it's another materialist utopia, and again, it seems to share a lot of the pathologies of those utopias. So all of them share the conceit that you can scientifically determine a true path, and the implication that there is a kind of point of arrival that is stable, whether that's full luxury communism or a more modest universal basic income. But that's that idea of a kind of Eden-like end, a kind of Edenic solution, has historically tended to blind materialist utopias to the social dysfunction that they inflict en route to that glorious end. It also misses the basic democratic assumption that, given that we are kind of inescapably chaotic and conflictual as humans, it's good to have procedures for consensual decision making and compromise en route, because those conflicts will never end. The text, Inventing the Future, seems to continue again the very narrow materialism of Marxism-Leninism and the neoclassical tradition that's behind neoliberalism. So it implies something that's good for all time. It is, again, securing the basic necessities of life, the expansion of social resources, and the extension of technological capacities. And the main difference, the most striking difference between them, this is where I worry that it gets really crude in political theoretical terms, is that it's about method, essentially, that they have these sort of deep affinities in the narrowness of the goal and the conception of the goal. But they differ in the in sort of how that paradise is going to be efficiently achieved. So for Marxist-Leninists, the principle of a rationally ordered good society is known. It's more factories, more machines, more control over nature, and that simply needs to be implemented. For neoclassical economists, it's the science of markets is well known. It simply needs to be fully adopted and deployed, and so the state needs to be got out of the way to allow the automaticity of markets to work. Now, unfortunately, the automaticity in the neoclassical picture is completely dependent on the kind of clockwork cosmos analogies that are embedded in the Newtonian mechanics that is at the root of neoclassical economics. So it's a utopia constituted by analogies to Newtonian mechanics. It was never based on observations of actual societies, which is why it works so badly. The determinism in accelerationism sounds like technological determinism. And this says that the technological capacity to substitute for labor will be there eventually. And apparently not only can we accelerate towards it, but we will suddenly become rational enough to deploy it to the widest possible social good when it becomes available. So it's an affinity in all three utopias that the achievement of the perfect society unfortunately requires a kind of perfect rationality to be reached. So in Marxism-Leninism, it's a perfect social rationality that's been inculcated through society by the Communist Party. Following the achievement of the perfect social rationality, all the planning mechanisms of the state will no longer be necessary. The achievement of kind of an automatic altruism will enable the Edenic condition of communism. In the neoliberal utopia, the free society is to be achieved through free markets and a might-watchman state. As people are liberated to exercise their natural utilitarian rationality, social order kept by a social tradition. Again, the state is going to wither away. In the implementation of both ideas, it turns out this perfect rationality has to exist for any of the transitional strategies to work the way they're supposed to work. So for Soviet central planning to work, everyone has to already operate with perfect social rationality, but they were stubbornly human, and so it became a byword for self-dealing and shortages. In the current neoliberal dystopia, we get the worst of markets and states because Homo economicus is the exception, not the norm. Given the inescapable realities of complexity and uncertainty, markets tend to depend and rely on interventionist states not to produce their worst tendencies. So you're pushing the state away in the supply side revolution, guess what? You get the worst of markets. And it turns out you also get the most bureaucratic elements of states when you try and make them imitate market mechanisms. So yet again, it looks like accelerationism needs a perfectly rational motivating agency to work, but it's not clear to me what that is. So I'd be interested to hear what the rational agency is supposed to be. If it's Marx's teleology of a kind of high-class consciousness of the full development of monopoly capitalism, then we're straight back to the Leninist problem of figuring out the revolutionary strategy that Marx never articulated, but I'll come back to the practical politics in a bit. But in the meantime, you get the impression of three programs, Marxism-Leninism, neoliberalism, and accelerationism, which are all dependent on a consistent rationality. And as such, they're kind of practical strategies for government in the way that Baron von Munchausen pulling himself out of the swamp by his own hair is a practical strategy. The quality and the virtues of liberal democracy are that it's not a blueprint for a substantive solution that is good for all time. It doesn't require a perfect rationality. It's more humble than that. It's a relatively ethical and inclusive set of procedures for making continuous adaptive decisions in an inescapably uncertain world. So I think it's right to be afraid of the hubris in materialist utopias. I think they draw us away from the human condition, which is vulnerable, interdependent, wholly dependent on nature, and completely incapable of precisely knowing the future. So what strikes me about the materialist utopias is that they're a very human expression of the desire to stop having to think, to say, we know the answer and then we can all rest, but there is no rest. The human condition is to never reach a point that is the end of our complexity. Rather than trying to achieve perfection in an imperfectible world, what the left ought to be trying to do is finding the fairest and most sustainable way of managing chronic imperfection. I think as such, all three utopias are very religious in quality. They imply an endemic state, a return to life before the fall. Apparently, in the case of Marxism, Leninism, and accelerationism, that's a return to the communism from which capitalism wrenched us. But as such, they're closer to religions than to practical political strategies. And practical political strategies have to contend with the world as it is in order to help achieve a world as we would like it to be. And as such, I'd also completely join your prosecution of the scientism in it. Because Marxism, Leninism, neoclassical economics, and accelerationism are clearly pseudosciences. And I think we should critique them and call that critique empiricist rather than parochial. It's not clear to me how accelerationism is calibrated against reality any more than either of the previous two materialist utopias, even though it's the calibration of theory against evidence that defines the natural sciences, and it defines all the social science, most of the social sciences that aren't neoclassical economic. So an important question need is to call out the pseudoscience in these utopias that are overwhelmingly dependent on deductive rather than inductive thought. Again, I think that makes them fundamentally antagonistic to democracy, because any democratic ideology has to accept that, given the inescapable fact of uncertainty, ontological uncertainty, epistemological uncertainty, all ideologies are necessarily contingent. They're necessarily works in progress. And it's that humility around what we can know and what anyone else can know it's that that's essential for the kind of stable ecumenical pluralism that actually is the foundation of democracy. As my colleagues Jonathan White and Leah Eep point out, democratic political justification is inherently comparative. So you need to justify something, but in order to justify it, you need to explain how it compares favorably to alternatives. So within things that claim to be scientific, there is this kind of automatic exclusion of alternatives, because this is the thing that is scientific, and competitors to the idea are implicitly not or less scientific. The trouble with any ideology that claims to be rooted in fallible science is, in the first place, it's ignorant of the reality of paradigm shifts in science, and it's bound to fall into the trap of deriding any ideology that doesn't make a claim to be based on science as primitive or parochial. Marxism-Leninism and neoliberalism fall into that trap, and as such, they, in requiring a perfect rationality, they're totalitarian ideas by definition. They require our transformation to a perfectly consistent human form, and hence they exclude something that's essential for democracy, which is a critical and viable proposition. I think part of the democratic function of political parties and justification is that they stimulate the generation of principled alternatives, remembering that we're in an imperfect and essentially unknowable world in terms of the future, so those, that constant creation of alternatives is a constant need in a healthy political system. And materialist utopias tend to exclude that process. That makes them pretty dangerous. Competing with pseudosciences for democratic parties is very difficult. You either critique the foundations, and in the case of neoliberalism, the left failed to do that, particularly under Blair, or you're forced to try and participate on the same field by making similarly improbable claims to the scientific validity of your own program. Pseudoscience is the wrong playing field for democratic politics as such. It's where terrible atrocities get committed in the name of claims to infallibility that always turn out not to be true. Brings me back to practical politics. So from the point of view of practical politics, again, I agree basically with the problems in this. In the first place, the trouble with the teleology of Ulrich Beck, but also of Anthony Giddens, who kind of took a similar line in some ways, is I think they're not so much inventing the future as rewriting the past. I would object that the ontological cement of our community identities wasn't so much organically lost. It didn't wither away. It was actively bulldozed by a bipartisan agreement from the 1980s onwards to replace the structure of the public sphere with those of business because of the neoliberal turn in politics. So this replaced public discourses of cooperation with a decidedly monocultural narrative about transactional individualism and tried to disallow anything else. And Giddens wrote along really similar lines to Beck in Modernity and Self-Identity, where he says the old bureaucratic systems start to disappear, the dinosaurs of post-traditionist age. And Anthony Giddens gave some of the best sociology lectures I've ever seen at the LSE, but this is a really untenable claim. I think the bureaucratic systems of the British state have been deliberately and consciously privatized, outsourced, and agentified by the ideological push of the supply side revolution. The idea that it's an institutional order that declined as part of some spontaneous emanation of a changing society and its longing for a new life politics is completely contradicted by the facts on the ground. I think this makes accelerationism a completely inadequate politics for the left. It fails to address the crisis of state failure, which is the contemporary crisis, and it fails to address climate change, which is the crisis that is now coming down the pipe. Accelerationism, like Giddens' view of a new life politics, comes across as an oddly complacent middle class kind of utopia. It projects a polity of the urban, educated, and networked people seeking their own enhancement. And that reality already exists for a particular social cohort. But there's no evidence at all that it's particularly egalitarian in any of its impulses. The Brexit vote pitched urban, networked, educated, and notably youthful voters in the ICT economy, those of us who work in the knowledge economy, against those who work or who used to work in the agricultural, industrial, and mid-range technology sectors. and the material interests of those different groups are strikingly divergent until a new political ideology can somehow frame some kind of common cause between them, and I don't think accelerationism does that. The tech-enabled constituency actively prefers the flexible labour markets of neoliberalism in which they benefit, and they're relatively able to self-insure around issues like health, education and social care. These constituencies have done absolutely, well, little, shall we say, to stop the hollowing out of the welfare state or of the state as a developmental actor. Even though Brexit has definitely operated as a wake-up call, I think, in terms of how that constituency thinks about wider social politics. The networked urban constituency is already with us, and it's less, and again, it marks less the kind of dawn of an egalitarian utopia than an increasingly polarized society. And I think the authors behind accelerationism are kind of showing the neoliberal 90s, in that regardless of the whiff of Marxist inevitability, the focus remains on self-realization in a fully rational materialist world, and it's very much the emphasis on self-realization. The quote you've got from Deleuze, or Deleuze, is amazing. Suggestion, there are only relations of movement and rest, speed and slowness between unformed elements, or at least between elements that are relatively unformed, molecules and particles of all kind. It's fascinating to me because it's a straight allusion to Newtonian mechanics, which is the root of neoclassical economics. Its roots don't look Marxist, that sounds like Bohr's.
It's actually from Lewis Coyne, right? Who's interpreting that as.
No,
he's citing it.
Okay,
I need to wrap up. Probably it's worth wrapping up with the naivety in accelerationism in political terms, which strikes me as immense. Corporations and tech corporations in particular have no aspiration to let go of their authority or to socialize it. They put tremendous financial resources into doing the opposite. Corporations, multinational corporations in general, spend phenomenal resources lobbying states to make sure that when capital moves across borders, it doesn't get followed by national laws trying to insist on social obligations. The idea that accelerating capitalism leads to the intensification of the contradictions and that this will lead ipso facto to some kind of sudden socialist rationality strikes me as just with the birds. Which gets me to Karl Polanyi. I think Karl Polanyi would have been pessimistic about the opportunity to secure a basic income in a post-labour world. Polanyi argued that the effective force against total commodification in capitalism was the human character of labour. So if you lose the human character of labour and it becomes redundant for a large proportion of the population, I think Polanyi would say to the accelerationists, where is the leverage for your ideas, with no intrinsic productivist need to listen to a newly redundant labouring class, I'd have thought automation risks being more like the Morlocks and LOI of H.G. Wells' Time Machine than the kind of accelerationist vision. We can argue about the realistic cost of universal basic income, but the prior political question is why would the economically more powerful classes in any way accept it or vote for it, except through the requirement to keep demand in the economy. I find that an increasingly dystopian vision. If the only leverage labour has to insist that it needs to be kept fed to keep consuming at ever-increasing levels, it's a Faustian bargain without the dignity of work in a society where those in the knowledge economy will still be in work and will hold political economic power. It's also unrealistic about automation. That's something we could get to later. Artificial intelligence requires big data to work effectively. AI needs that data and the decision points to be as value-free as possible. That takes us back to the limits of human rationality and uncertainty. Even if you limit epistemological uncertainty with incredible amounts of data, you still can't escape ontological uncertainty. So that means in any context where there is imagination or creativity or changing preferences or policy changes or emergent novelty, that is to say, in any kind of free society, the future won't be like the past, and hence the dependence on past data is going to introduce framing biases and be inadequate, if not dysfunctional, in running anything too complicated or important. The bottom line to the criticism is that given the realities of climate change, which leads me to Rupert eventually, any materialist utopia based on abundance and increased consumption is actually a recipe for dystopia. Call it what you like, it ignores the only actual science in this discussion, which is the science around climate.